In the mid-1960s, I was into the music my teenage older siblings liked, like the Beatles and the Stones. But I also listened to my parents' albums by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, that loungy, jazzy, James Bondy pseudo-Latino music spoke to a boy of 11 going on 12. And as the decades went on, Herb Alpert kept producing hits. It's hard to overstate Alpert's influence on pop music. Apart from his own hits, he co-founded a major record label, A&M, and launched lots of big careers, from the Carpenters to the Police. Herb Alpert is now 79, and he's got a new record, his 40th, called In the Mood, which he's backing with a nationwide tour. When we spoke back in 2012, he told me his career began all because he had trouble speaking up as a kid.
You know, I was very lucky in my grammar school. They had a music appreciation class, and there were a bunch of instruments on a table. And I happened to pick out the trumpet, and I tried to make some sound out of it, and I couldn't, which intrigued me. And I was very, very shy as a young kid. So when I finally did make noise out of it, it was speaking for me.
And did you do more than just the songs they make you play in school bands? Were you, like, picking up jazz riffs?
I'm fortunate I have very good relative pitch, so if I hear a song on the radio, I can just play it right back. And I don't know how it happens. I just seem to press the right valves.
So you were suddenly the Charlie Parker of your set?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. No, I was, you know, I have a very classical background. When I was going to USC, I was playing in the orchestra there, and they were playing Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky that was arranged by Ravel. And I got so enamored with the sound of the orchestra, I was leaning forward. I was in the back row with the trumpet section. I was leaning forward, listening to this thing, and it sounded, I said, man, that's great. It sounds like stereo or something. You know, it's just a beautiful sound. And I forgot to come in. I forgot to play my part. So right from that point, I just said, hey, you know something? I'm not that interested in playing other people's music. I want to close my eyes and just, you know, invent my own thing.
How interesting, though, that this classic romantic piece, Mussorgsky and Ravel, that seems right for Herb Alpert to have sort of lost his mind over.
Well, it certainly washed over me, and I'm a big fan of Ravel. I love his, you know, his drama. There's something about the way he orchestrated that really touched me. You know, little by little, I was looking for my own voice. I was drafted in the Army in 1954, and they sent me to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
And no war going on, fortunately.
Well, that was very fortunate. So I go to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I run into like 12 trumpet players that were better than me, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They could play higher, faster, louder. Better jazz. You know, they were just something that really made me think, if I'm ever going to make it in this music industry, I better come up with my own identity. And that's what I worked on when I was released.
And you were also working on being a producer. I mean, you helped discover Sam Cooke and Janet
Dean.
I didn't
discover Sam Cooke. I was working for the company along with Lou Adler. Lou Adler and I were partners, and we worked for this Keen Records, and became really good friends with Sam. We wrote A Wonderful World with him. Don't know much about history, that song. And I learned a lot from Sam because he came out of the gospel field. You know, mm-hmm. Everything had to do with a feel. It had to feel good. It had to feel good, you know.
Was that a meaningful thing for you? I mean, as a producer, did you then try to say, okay, I think I know what he means, and try to feel it?
Well, he used to say, Herbie, it's a cold piece of wax, man. It either makes it or it don't.
I hold you responsible for so much of my youth. Tell me the story behind the song that made me hear of you when I was 7 or 8 years old for the first time, The Lonely Bull, which we would play over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana for several years during the spring. They had world-class matadors there, and I kind of got, you know, I became a fan of that.
You would drive down from Southern California?
Drive down from Los Angeles. And there was this brass band in the stands that would announce all the sequence of events. Ba-da! Ba-da-da-ba-da-da-ba-da-ba! Ole! Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da! And people in the stands would go crazy. And I was kind of taken by that. I liked that feeling. And the more I drank wine out of my Bota bag, the better I liked it. No, there was something about that feeling that I thought maybe I could translate it into a sound. And then I played it for a disc jockey friend of mine, and he said, "Man, you need some hooks. You got to put a hook in there." I said, "What do you mean a hook?" He says, "Well, something that people can remember." So an engineer friend of mine, Ted Keeps, had a tape of 30,000 people screaming "Ole" at a bullfight. I put that on right in the front of the Lonely Bull. And months later, I would get cards and letters from people all over the world saying, "Thanks for taking me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana."
No, and that, since it didn't really belong in any existing pop category, were you surprised when it became this gigantic hit record?
Yeah, I was taken off guard for sure. Yeah, I didn't think it was going to start a record company. This was the first record we released on A&M. This was A&M 101, and that was the start of...
And you were A of A&M.
I was the A, and that was the start of something really grand.
And then, when I was 11 years old and playing the trumpet in Omaha, Nebraska, came your gigantic album, Whipped Cream.
Right.
1965. And I was just the right age to spend hours staring at the cover because it was a naked girl, apparently naked girl, covered in whipped cream. And I played the trumpet, and there was all this trumpet was kind of cool suddenly on this record. So you'd been doing Tijuana Brass for a while, but that took it to a new stratosphere.
Well, it did take it to a new level, and... You know, there was no Tijuana Brass group.
There was you.
Yeah, it was a sound that I created while overdubbing my horn on top of my horn, basically up through the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. And that girl, Dolores Erickson, who was the model on the Whipped Cream cover, she was 3 months pregnant. And also she was covered in shaving cream.
So we couldn't have eaten it. So Tijuana Brass plays entirely instrumentals at a time when singer, songwriter, rock and roll is just coming in. You were like the first pop musical brand creator. I mean, this band, which, by the way, had no Hispanics in it, playing this Latinish music, is suddenly everywhere. I even remember on the Dating Game.
It's the Dating Game! And here's the star of our show and your host.
Did you ever worry? Did that worry you, or was getting the royalties good enough?
Worry me about in what sense?
Well, that your music was being reduced to sort of goofy game show theme music.
Oh, I didn't think about it. I couldn't believe all the airplay we were getting and the amount of records we were selling. I mean, there was an experience I had. My partner, there was just the two of us when we started A&M, and my partner, Jerry Moss, one time he got a call from our distributor, and he said, "Herbie, how fast can you send me 104,000 albums? I said, "You're kidding. You need 104,000 albums? I says, "You must really like this record." He says, "I never heard it, but we're selling a lot of tonnage." I mean, that was the first time I thought of music.
How flattering.
Reduced to weight.
So A&M Records, your label with Jerry Moss, is growing and growing. What acts are you proudest of signing?
Well, I guess the Carpenters, because, yeah. I mean, they were the biggest act we had. I mean, there was something about them that I liked very much when I heard the tape. I heard this tape sitting in my office at A&M, and I had two speakers on the floor, and I was sitting on my couch about 10 feet away from the speakers, closing my eyes, which Sam Cooke taught me to do, by the way. So I closed my eyes, and I was listening to this tape. And it felt like Karen Carpenter's voice was sitting right next to me. Her voice is projected right out of the speakers.
Why do birds suddenly appear?
It wasn't the type of music that I would normally listen to, but there was something about them that I really loved.
Just like me, they long to be close to you.
And then the first album that was released by the Carpenters didn't sell at all. I mean, it was like a turkey, as they say.
And this, by the way, is what, 1970?
Yeah, 1970.
So here we have over here Jimi Hendrix and Cream, and here's the Carpenters.
Yeah. The Carpenters didn't sell, and then people in my own company were looking at me like, why did you sign these goods? You know, I mean, if they're too soft, it can't happen. And Karen was playing drums at the time. And I heard the recording, and I said, this is too soft. We got to put a little energy on this.
So they sprinkle moon dust in your hair and gold starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why all the girls in town.
And so they did, and Close You was the door opener for them. And, you know, after... They zoomed through that door and started selling millions of records. You know, the people in my own company were looking at me like, man, the guy's not too bad.
He still got it.
Yeah.
Then you, the next time I remember hearing you as musician as opposed to you as record executive was, I guess, 1979 with the song Rise, which was a disco hit.
Well, it wasn't exactly a disco hit because it happened because my nephew, Randy Alpert, who goes under the name of Captain Badass, by the way, wrote the song with his buddy, Andy Armour, and they wanted me to do the Tijuana Brass records in disco, you know, with the boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I gave it a shot. We went in the studio and started fooling around with Taste of Honey in a disco beat, and I just couldn't handle it. I got nauseous. Quite frankly, I did.
Really?
Well, I just felt like, geez, why trample on it? These songs are already hits, and they were good. Let's just leave them. I had some studio time left, and they had this song called Rise, and they wanted to do it as boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I said, look, let's just slow this thing down to 100 beats per minute so people, after they're dancing apart, can get together and dance, you know, a little more romantically. So we did that, and it became a big hit. Ah, yeah, that's that bass line.
There it is.
That's been copied many times.
Well, not only copied, but then had a whole new life 20 years later in Biggie's.
Yeah,
Notorious
it did.
B.I.G.'s song, Hypnotize.
Hypnotize, and it was a big, big, big record.
When you first heard it sampled and looped and used in a hip-hop hit that way, what did you think? Like, I've been around too long? I'm in some loop?
You know something, to tell you the truth, to be quite honest, I'm not crazy about when artists take someone else's material and uses it. That means they can't think for themselves, you know? I'm not regretting that he did it, you know.
Yeah.
It was a big hit record, and it was a good record, too.
And you must have done okay with the fees they pay you for sampling that. A lot of jazz musicians would count themselves lucky.
Well, I think so. You know how you make $1 million playing jazz, by the way?
Hmm.
You start with $3 million. Bit-a-boom, bit-a-boom.
Herb Alpert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Herb Alpert's latest album with his wife Lonnie Hall is called In the Mood, and it'll be out at the end of September. You can see a slideshow of all of his very groovy record covers on our website, studio360.org.